Take a network break. It's late summer. I'm harvesting cucumbers from my local garden, so today we're going to hand out virtual pickles instead of virtual donuts. We'll see what kind of audience reception we get. Today's episode is sponsored in part by Apstra. Apstra enables continuous automation and validation of your data center network architecture and operations. You can find out more at apstra.com/packetpushers. We're also sponsored by VMware's VMworld, which is taking place September 29th to October 1st as a live virtual event. You can register right now to see keynotes, deep dive technical sessions, and more at VMworld.com. Let's dive right into the news. Arista is making a SaaS version of its Cloud Vision management software. With the SaaS version, you can manage Arista switches and access points as well as virtualized instances of the EOS network OS from the cloud.
Yeah, so this is, to me, the logical progression that we're seeing all of the networking vendors, the original first generations of SDN controllers, you know, software-defined data centers, although Arista's been less focused on software-defined and SDN generally, mainly relying on customers to provide their own orchestration and automation solutions. Mm-hmm. Would that be fair?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, they haven't really sort of thrown themselves into a platform like, you know, Juniper's Contrail or Apstra, you know, as a sponsor, you know, their orchestration engines. I think that Arista's sort of been dragged, not quite kicking and screaming, but a recognition that the market has gone down the path. They would, I suspect, be happier just making switches and just doing that. And the addition of CloudVision is about following the market for them. And we saw them announce the CloudVision product, I think, 2 years ago. And the natural progression now is that SaaS is making its way into the marketplace. Uh-huh. People don't want to be deploying it on-prem if they cannot help it. There's some part of the market that doesn't want that. There's a lot of us that do want to do it ourselves. We want to buy it outright and deploy it. But as long as they keep the licensing simple, and I don't have to waste my life endlessly in licensing and pricing negotiations, right, I'm kind of all for it, you know?
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, it's you can do all of the things that you could do in CloudVision on-premises. You can still do in the SaaS version, so provisioning your switches, configuring them. You can collect the telemetry. You're getting the analytics, the monitoring, et cetera. For me, it was Arista finally catching up to where folks like Cisco Meraki have been. Extreme already does it. Juniper, Aruba, they've had this capability to manage from the cloud for years, so Arista, I guess, finally decided to join the party.
Yeah, and they're also laying out a roadmap here. And I think that's an important part of this announcement is that they're saying a key part of the briefing that we got was they're talking about 2021 needs, which is inference-driven network-wide workflows, so that's intent-based networking, automated machine-driven, so that's, you know, click a workflow and it does a thing, or we use APIs to do a thing. They're folding in real-time and streaming telemetry, so that's the visibility and the analytics piece that I often talk about for SDN. And they're going into multi-domain network visibility, so this idea that you don't just want to have one SaaS instance for one data center, you want one instance to cover all of your domains. And I think in particular with Arista, the slide deck talks about the CloudVision as a service, as it does with CloudVision. Sometime in the future, we'll manage the data center, the inter-data center data networking, the campus, and multi-cloud networking. Now, some of those aren't here yet, but they're laying out a vision that CloudVision is going to grow over time and that strategically they'll be there when you're ready. You know, by the time you're ready to have all these things, they'll have a product that's, you know, got ticks in the boxes for what you buy today. I think that's the story they're trying to tell.
Yeah, they're also trying to tell the story of how once they get a lot of customers using the cloud-based version, they're going to have a big data set to work with. And that means they can enhance their capabilities for things like anomaly detection, predictive analytics, that whole AI magic that lots of vendors are coding their products in these days.
Yeah, and that's important because you can't do machine learning or AI or even, you know, reasonably good linear regression without a certain amount of data, right, on which to base a base, you know, to extract baselines. Right. So I think it's not quite a catch-up move, but it's certainly a competitive move to keep up with where the industry has moved to, I think. And I mean, the thing I like about SaaS offerings at the end of the day is that vendors have to live with what they ship. And the thing is, that's actually an incentive for them to make a product that actually works. Because if they deploy trash code into their SaaS platform, they actually have to live with it, not you. And right, there's actually an incentive for them to actually, like when you buy these management products and these software products and we put them on-prem over the last 20 years, the vendor actually was incentivized to ship a trash product because then they could charge you money for tech support as maintenance contracts. And weirdly, people thought they were getting good value for money for those contracts because they would ring up tech support and use the tech support. The point is that the product should be good enough and stable enough and reliable enough to actually work out of the box. And if it doesn't, you should actually be asking for a refund. But the thing about SaaS offerings is it actually puts the vendor on the hook for it to actually work. You just want to use it, and they have to make it work. And there's actually an incentive there for these SaaS offerings to actually be better than the on-prem offerings, which is weird, but that's actually the way.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because I was just doing a day two cloud recording with Ned Bellavance, and we were talking to our guest about Azure, and he made the comment that now that Microsoft has to actually run its own software, you know, via Azure, suddenly the software development has gotten a lot better. So there's definitely some truth to that. I think with Arista, they've sort of based their value proposition around good software development, good, strong, stable code. So they can leverage that certainly for SaaS. I feel like from a positioning standpoint, they are playing catch up. But Arista, I think, has never been one to chase trends. They want to see how the market develops and where the actual value is and then do a fast follow. I think that's what's happening here. And again, they can, now that they're building this cloud platform, they see other ways they can leverage it going forward.
Yeah, and I guess in that sense, I've said before that in many ways, Arista is a better Cisco than Cisco. So it produces better switches with better software quality using the same, you know, hardware that's a hell of a lot easier to use, you know, and so forth and so on. And Cisco is very much a follower. It's not an innovator. Mm-hmm. It doesn't breach the market. It waits for some startups to go out there and make a market. Right. And then it innovates through acquisition and it buys those companies and deploys them. So there's no way I think we could have a debate that would rationally describe Cisco and Arista as innovators.
Right.
That is not true.
No.
Right. They definitely follow the market once the trend's established and customers are asking them for it. So when you see a customer, when you see vendors out there saying, "Oh, we're customer led, we're absolutely customer," that's usually a code word for we don't spend money on R&D. We wait for customers to ask us for something and then we develop it for them. And Arista is very much in that mold. But Arista is very smart about what they say no to equally, which is something Cisco is not good at. Cisco will do anything for a deal. You know, you want to put 17-inch mag wheels on that 25-year-old clunker? Absolutely, son. I'll get you those, you know, without telling you that the 17-inch wheels are going to, you know, scratch on the edge, on the outside of the, on the bodywork as it drives off the lot, right?
Right.
So,
and also just being very disciplined in markets they go into. For instance, you know, Cisco decided it wanted to sell servers, so suddenly it's got UCS and so on. Arista has been very focused on switching. Mm.
Exactly. And they haven't gone too lateral, but they have to. They have to get growth. Investors, their financial results are clear that they're struggling for growth. Investors believe that Arista's got a challenge around cloud providers because it's 35% of its revenue comes from three customers or something.
Right.
And, you know, if Microsoft or, you know, whoever it is, we know Microsoft is one, you know, if Microsoft suddenly decides that it doesn't want Arista chassis anymore, then Arista share price takes a big tumble. And so Arista shares are discounted on the assumption that that's a risk that investors have to take. Yep.
All right. Well, links in the show notes if you want to find out more about this new SaaS offering. Let's move on. Cisco Systems and Megaport are partnering to integrate Cisco's SD-WAN with Megaport's cloud on-ramp and data center interconnect services. They're calling this the Megaport Virtual Edge. The goal is to make it easy to tie branch locations into Megaport's global POPs and its connections with managed service providers.
Now, this is very interesting in the sense that we haven't typically talked about these virtual POP companies or these virtual overlay networks. And Megaport's business is about putting POPs in a range of different hosting facilities and other people's data centers. And then you connect them to your colo data center or you bring a tail into your private data center. And then they've got some sort of software configurability about where you want the other end to be. Mm-hmm. So if you want to provision a direct connect to AWS, for example, then provided you've got a Megaport line into your facility, whether that's most likely it's in a colo, just click a couple of buttons and boom, you've got an MPLS circuit, dedicated piece of bandwidth, scalable on demand, typically in minutes or perhaps days even, if you've got to provision the circuit, because, you know, running cable inside a colo is pretty straightforward.
Right.
So that's what they've been doing. But now what they're doing is partnering with Cisco Viptela, and making it so that the Viptela SD-WAN components can use the Megaport network as a backhaul. So that means that your SD-WAN can now use their Megaport network to backhaul directly into AWS Direct Connect and Azure's version of that and so on and so forth. So this is interesting because getting SD-WAN into your cloud is not exactly straightforward. And so this partnership is an interesting one, something that Cisco doesn't normally do.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a good deal for Megaport because they get easier access to Cisco's customer base, and it gives Cisco a stronger story to tell about streamlining and accelerating access to cloud services. If you want something more than just offloading to the internet to get your branch office up to SaaS in the cloud, Megaport can promise faster and very easy to configure connections. Mm.
Yeah, the way that SD-WAN works and the way that most of the clouds work is you can't just drop a VM inside of your VPC and then terminate your SD-WAN there. There's a whole bunch of rules and proprietary features inside of the clouds that, you know, you can only do a gigabit per flow, right? And if you want 10 gigs, you kind of either have to have 10 VMs or you have all, and then you've got load balancing problems and then you've got configuration problems and so on and so forth. And Viptela's previous incarnation before Cisco had acquired them, they were partnering with people to do exactly this. So people were actually putting racks of gear inside of Equinix, putting up Viptela's SD-WAN headends and then virtualizing them so that customers could terminate and get in. This is another version of that. So it's a good deal for Megaport. What's unusual here is that Cisco normally doesn't partner with companies like this. So this is an integration between the Viptela vManage service that's held in the cloud, and it actually talks directly to Megaport for the provisioning, as best as I can tell from the reviews that I've seen.
Yes.
And Cisco is historically not good at that. So it's not good at partnering with people. So I would be a little cautious expecting Cisco vManage to correctly work with Megaport. And the onus here would be on Megaport to make it work because they're the baby partner.
Right.
And Cisco's going to bully them around. So my initial reaction is this is a good thing. It enables SD-WAN to do a thing. The second reaction is Cisco's not very good at these sorts of partnerships. They tend to just get lazy or the lack of focus. You know, this is a very small part of their business. People just go like, well, you know, it's only affecting like 30 or 40 customers. Not a big deal. We'll just do that when, you know, just ignore that. Mm. And then it dies a death of ignorance after a while. So I'm a little cautious about that.
It is still a beta program. It's expected to be GA in the first half of 2021, but I think they are accepting beta customers if you're interested.
Yeah, Megaport's a tiny, tiny company, so they've got no leverage on Cisco.
Right. Be careful, yeah. Megaport.
Yeah, strategic buying. You've got to be careful. Go into it with your eyes open. Yes.
A next story, an advocacy group called the Great Firewall Report says China is blocking TLS 1.3 connections that use the encrypted server name indication, or ESNI. Because ESNI encrypts identifying information about the server, it's harder for authorities to prevent users from reaching censored sites. So now China is just outright dropping any packets on connections that are using ESNI and TLS 1.3.
Yeah, this is a long-standing move by the IETF and the ISOC. And one of the key factors of TLS was that they included the SNI, which is the fundamentally the secure name identifier, I think as it stands for, server name indication.
Yeah, server name indication.
Which is says this is the server that I'm attempting to connect to. And that was in clear text. And obviously, if you're attempting to do censorship or blocking, or if you're going to do proxying or filtering, the original idea behind it was that we always had that name and there was a bunch of services out there that needed that. And so on and so forth. And then there was a move by the IETF. Now, the IETF and ISOC generally has, as part of its mandate or part of its policies, a requirement to keep user privacy as a maximum priority. Uh-huh. That is, it's not enough to just sort of say, I don't worry about it, or, you know, whatever. They actually actively initiate standards that will protect user privacy. And so what they're talking about here is that TLS 1.3 with ESNI, which is encrypting the SNI deeper into the header. This was actually identified in the IETF, but was felt to be too difficult, you know, 5 years ago. Well, now the new ESNI. And if you now make a TLS 1.3 request with an ESNI, then China will just block you out completely. Mm-hmm. Now, the general assumption here is that the Chinese want to be able to control what leaves the country. They don't want people making uncontrolled connections out. That has been their policy politically for a long period of time. And we've talked previously about the fact that, you know, Europe and the US and Australia, for example, are also making moves to get control of the internet traffic at the network level. Instead of legislating on the users and the apps, they're saying to the people like Facebook and Google, you need to do things. And if they don't do those things, what are the governments going to do?
Right.
And at some point, they're going to have to take control of the network. So part of what the ESNI move was about, and it's clear, is that once you've got this here, it can block censorship or make it incredibly difficult, because if you don't have the name, you can only block by IP address.
Right.
So you need to remember that the IP address is most often in a content delivery network. So if you suddenly start blocking Akamai or Fastly or Cloudflare, you suddenly start blocking 50% of the internet.
Right.
Right. Yeah. You could end up with a, yeah. So not a good idea. But the challenge now is ESNI only works if everything else is ESNI. So this strategy of blocking ESNI will fail if every other website in the world uses ESNI to protect user privacy. Mm-hmm. So now it's a race between China's going to block it, so you won't see any traffic coming out of China to drive adoption. But if the rest of the world moves to switch the browsers and clients and curl and, you know, all the apps around the world switch to using ESNI by default, then the theory is that eventually countries that want to force censorship will be prevented because everybody's using it and significant chunks of the internet won't work if you do.
Right.
So that's the logic.
Yeah, right now it's a very blunt instrument, and we know that censorship is a cat and mouse game. The censors apply some kind of control and folks find a way around it. Speaking of which, the report says that China's system can be thwarted using a research project from the University of Maryland called Geneva, which uses genetic algorithms to find ways around blocking techniques. And we did a heavy networking episode with the professor and graduate student who created Geneva. It's number 488 if you're interested in checking it out. It's a pretty interesting conversation.
Yep. And I was reading a research paper from the University of Massachusetts, and they're talking about the importance of ESNI to censorship circumvention. And they actually published results on the level of blocking that's actually occurring in China today around ESNI. So if you want to get deeper into it, and that's how come I suddenly know so much about ESNI, because I spent a day reading that research paper and a bunch of others. So yes.
Yep, there's a PDF to that research report plus other links in the show notes if you want to go check it out. Quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, Apstra. Apstra continuously automates and validates both the data center network's architecture and operations against your desired intent. They use a single source of truth and intent-based analytics to eliminate complexity, vulnerabilities, and outages so that you get reliable, secure, and resilient networking even in the presence of day-to-day changes. The unique value for customers is that Apstra unifies all lifecycle stages by effectively converging design with operations. So with Apstra, your operations begin at day zero, delivering higher value to the business and elevating your infrastructure. On average, Apstra customers realize an 80% improvement in operational efficiency, 70% improvement in mean time to resolution, and a 90% improvement in infrastructure agility. Benefits include end-to-end automation that starts at day zero, a dramatic reduction in tooling costs, intent-based analytics, reliable change management, and more. You can find out all of this at apstra.com/packetpushers. That's apstra.com/packetpushers. We thank them for being a sponsor.
Hmm.
Back to the news, Lumina Networks, they supported a version of the open source SDN controller Open Daylight for telcos. They are shutting their doors. Apparently, the startup had contracts with AT&T, Verizon, among others, but it wasn't sufficient funding to support its operations.
Yeah, case of the service provider industry shooting itself in the foot, probably with double foot guns in the long term.
The deadly double foot guns.
Yeah, the devil. So Lumina Networks, of course, is the Open Daylight version that came with Brocade. If you remember the Brocade Networks, they made a big push around Open Daylight and had many contributors and were providing commercial support for Open Daylight. Open Daylight's very popular with service providers for doing MPLS operations, like for configuring and operating MPLS networks, and been widely used for that. But they weren't able to get enough revenue to keep the business model sustainably. So it's a careful shutdown. It's not a we ran out of money, gone into liquidation. It's like we can't see a path forward. We're going to shut down, hand back the money we can't spend and find places for our people to work. So the Twitter sphere is sort of talking about most of the employees are expected to be placed into jobs in the service providers who are using ODL.
Right.
And the product will continue on. I don't believe that Open Daylight is under any threat. There's plenty of people contributing to the project, especially out of China. Because it's very popular over there. I believe there's tens of thousands of deployments of the Open Daylight controller in parts of China. And they've also backed that up with teams of developers to make the product and to keep developing it and progressing with it. So the project will continue and people will not lose too much, except for people who wanted to buy support for Open Daylight. They'll now have a slightly harder life if you believe that, you know, open source needs support.
Right. Yeah, Open Daylight will continue to exist. It is a Linux Foundation project, so it does have substantial industry support, it will carry on. The official letter announcing the wind down said the transition within large telcos to open source didn't really happen fast enough, which means more revenue was going to proprietary vendors as opposed to open source projects like Lumina. They also say that VCs weren't willing to step in and support this. So yeah, I do see why you're saying it's a double foot guns for the telcos, because if they are tied into Open Daylight, instead of being able to buy support, now they're going to have to do it themselves.
Which would be better for them in the long run. At some point, you have to have these skills in-house. Yeah. Like the open source projects, when you're using them at its scale, you need to have in-house skills to be able to correctly identify faults and then identify the path to rectification. And that may sometimes be you internally, and sometimes that might be knowing the right people in the project to go and ask for help. And commercial support is sort of a structured way of doing that. That is, you can buy Open Daylight from Lumina Networks so that they know who knows. That's really what you're paying for, right? Because in an open source project, it's just about, that's how Red Hat works, right?
Right.
It knows everybody in the Red Hat, sphere. It knows who writes all the code. And if something needs support, they know who to go and talk to. That's all you're paying for, is people who know people. And so it is a shame in that sense. And I had hoped that Open Daylight would be a common SDN platform that we could all get around. And we've now ended up with these much smaller bundles. Open Daylight is a very big tool. It's like a Microsoft Word type, like a Microsoft Office tool. Mm-hmm. Very universal, very general purpose, and would have required people to customize it like you do with an Excel spreadsheet. An Excel program does nothing until you spend hundreds of hours producing a spreadsheet and then customize it to your need. Open Daylight was that model. But no, the industry has decided to balkanize, and you go over here and you buy Apstra, and you go over here and you buy Viptela VManage, and you go over here and you buy VeloCloud SD-WAN, and that's it. At one stage, we could have had something like Open Daylight underneath, and then snapped on to the top of that would have been these apps, but that's not the way it worked out.
Yeah, speaking from the enterprise perspective, back in the day, Open Daylight was sort of hallowed as the way to bring SDN into the enterprise data center. For one, SDN in the data center, essentially using the OpenFlow model, never really panned out, and folks sort of transitioned to commercial models like ACI and NSX, which is one of the reasons why I think VCs didn't get involved here, because there wasn't that big of a market and it wasn't all that lucrative.
Yeah.
So what was the exit for them? I sort of understand their perspective.
Yeah, Open Daylight was popular for a while when the incumbent vendors didn't want to do SDN.
Right.
They didn't believe in software. It was, they were all running around going, oh, SDN stands for still does nothing.
They were terrified that their switching was going to be commoditized. They didn't want that. That's why they sort of held SDN at arm's length for such a long time.
Yes. And it did happen anyway. So their switching has definitely been commoditized, right? There's no question. The impacts of white box and white brand, the mix of commoditized ASICs from a range of vendors and open source operating systems, that has been inevitable from the start and is having an impact. Cisco's struggling to sell its switches. That's why it's shrinking, because people are buying other people's switches, not Cisco's. And so look at Arista, come from nowhere on the back of standard silicon, merchant silicon. So a different era. Back in the days when all the vendors were coming together on SDN, because it actually made sense to have one SDN and they could sell their switches. And then later on they realized that it would be better to balkanize and to invent their own Excel spreadsheet and have a separate product for everybody rather than have a universal platform.
Yeah. All right, as always, links in the show notes if you want to learn more yourself. It's the circle of life with startups. One has passed away. Another one is springing up in its place. This time it's Ananda Networks. Ananda is a new competitor in secure remote access. Essentially, it creates an overlay that acts like a private network, so you can connect users and devices from any location to any location, but those users and devices are managed just as if they were on the corporate LAN.
And those users are the endpoints. So the unique thing about Ananda Networks is that they're producing a client to run on every platform, Mac OS, Windows, Android, iOS, and so forth. And when you put the client on, they then use the DTLS protocol, which is a UDP-based HTTP. They encapsulate the traffic and backhaul it across the internet using that mode. And then, of course, there's a control plane, a cloud-based controller, so that you can unify the configurations.
Yep.
Nothing particularly new here, in the sense that this is a pretty popular way of doing things, except for the fact that they're producing the agents. Now, there's a lot of action in this space. So it's called, sort of loosely called, software-defined perimeter, or endpoint detection EDR, endpoint detection and response. So you've got to have something on the endpoint. And when you do, when you put an agent on the endpoint, you can encapsulate the traffic into something else and then transport it across the internet. But then you've got to be able to maintain control of all of the software. You've got to have good agents. And, you know, on all of the devices, you have to have a centralized control point to make sure the policy is unified. And we've got other companies in this space, Akamai, Broadcom, Cato Networks, Cisco, Cloudflare, you know, Palo Alto, Fortinet, and their opaque acquisition just a few weeks ago, Zero Network, Zscaler. I know there's so many more. I'm not even listing all of them.
I mean, last week we just talked about a new startup doing very much the same thing called Elicity just last week. So yeah,
that's right.
More and more.
And we've got a show coming up soon with NetMotion Software, also in the same marketplace.
Yeah.
So this is obviously these companies are re-energized following COVID and the switch to working from home. It's also equally true that your existing IPsec model isn't going to scale. So using IPsec for remote access is not the right answer, no matter what you do. The way forward is absolutely DTLS. And the reason for that is you can get substantial performance improvements. IPsec is a very poor protocol for performance. It does the encapsulation and the encryption, but the performance in it is appallingly bad. It's not optimized in any way, shape, or form. And you'll increasingly see DTLS used for these networks. In fact, a lot of SD-WAN companies who talk about acceleration, where they get their acceleration from is using DTLS instead of IPsec. But
right? Yeah, Elicity, who we just mentioned, also is using DTLS as their overlay.
Sometimes they call it a proprietary protocol because that's not exactly DTLS, but they copied it and then made some changes to it. Like they add in keeper lives or some other things to it and make a proprietary protocol just because they're being lazy. It's easier to write your own protocol than it is to actually write a standard sometimes. So, but I think this is useful. I think they've got some unique approaches. It's just that endpoint. And they're also very much focused on accessing the cloud. So they're not as much about on-prem access, although they certainly do that, but they're very much focused on how do you have your remote. If you've got some sort of monolith app or legacy app and you're lifting and shifting it into the public cloud, how do you then control, you know, and that's not suitable for access over the internet. It's not HTTPS. It uses some, you know, arcane protocol that needs to run over an encrypted tunnel. Then Ananda Networks has got to differentiate it here because they're ready to go for that sort of application. And there are a wide range of approaches, like Cloudflare's is basically, as long as it works in a web browser, we can do your VPN.
Mm-hmm.
Not very helpful if you're not doing a web browser, right? So on and so forth. So there is a wide range of solutions in here and a diversity of features and functions in the early stages of innovation. That's normal. There'll be some convergence coming down the pipeline in a year or two. And until then, we'll just have to wait and see how it works out. So congratulations to Ananda for getting up.
Yeah, and from a timing perspective, you know, I think it's good for them. Despite the crowded market, lots of organizations are dealing with remote access. We know remote access is going to be the primary mechanism that most people get to work in the enterprise space for at least a year, and the general transition to remote work is going to have long-term impacts. So, you know, in terms of market inflection, they're at the right point. The only issue is it's such a crowded market, they're going to have to fight to get some attention.
Yeah, and ditch the cheesy marketing. Ananda is some yoga term for bliss or something.
Yes.
And so their byline is experience network bliss. And I'm like, please.
Yeah, there's a little too much Marie Kondo sparking joy in this marketing. I'd rather just know the details, but that's me.
Yeah, infrastructure people don't respond to that.
No.
Developers sometimes do. If you want to sell something to developers, having that sort of Marie Kondo hipster thing going on, it's not a bad thing.
I'm guessing the marketing folks are probably doing yoga, so they're like, yeah, this resonates, but it's not the right audience.
No. Infrastructure professionals tend to be, you know, have suffered decades of abuse, vendor abuse, and really not. So.
They're not going to believe you about network bliss. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. It's a tough sell.
That's true. Yeah. But that's a minor thing. The product seems to be fine.
The product seems to be right. This is a quibble. All right, moving on. Aster, they're our sponsor, just as a heads up, that they also do have some news. They have announced version 3.3 of their AOS intent-based networking software. The latest version includes support for the open-source Sonic Network OS and Juniper's Junos, among other new features.
Yeah, I think this is a sign that Aster is continuing to mature. So this is effectively V3.3. And as we went through the announcement, it looks like they've really been focusing on the operational enhancement capability. They're also a sponsor of today's show, so suitable disclosure.
Yep.
But I think there was a couple of things about version 3.3 that I liked. One was that you can now stage the configurations and then review the changes before deployment. In previous versions, you sort of clicked a button and boom, it was done. Many organizations want to review changes before deployment. It's stupid, but that's what they want.
It's sort of counterintuitive to intent-based networking that you would review the changes before you do this automatic system. But yes, I understand some people want to, you know, do the belt and suspenders approach and just be able to see it before anything happens.
ITIL is what it is. Stupid, but there it is. So the other thing that they can do is fabric locking, which is freezing the configuration during the deployment. So there's only one deployment at a time. Apparently, this is not a feature that was actually needed, but one that was asked for. Not so much because the configurations would get out of sync, but because if something went wrong with the change, they wouldn't be able to pinpoint it. So again, operational feature. They've increased the fabric visibility tooling to add heat maps of traffic hotspots and links under stress, making it easier to go find out where things are going wrong. They've boosted the role-based access control. And I think the two bits that really stand out to me is the validation of Juniper Junos, so that you can now use Juniper switches running Junos as the hardware plane and then run Apstra on top of that. And also qualifying Sonic operating system. And particularly, I think it was Dell Sonic that they were talking about.
My impression was that it was just the standard open source Sonic.
Open source Sonic. Yeah. Okay, right. Oh, that's right. Yes. And that is because telcos want that.
Right.
Yeah. So can we spell 5G? Because all of those 5G towers are going to have little ECMP networks in them where they're big enough and large enough, the 5G edges. And Apstra is one of those companies in there selling that as a configuration engine for those networks inside of those 5G edge networks.
Yeah, it's smart for Apstra to expand its capabilities to touch, to be able to support as many NOSes as it can. So obviously Junos and Sonic are two great additions.
Yeah, and the last feature they talked about was the Time Voyager, which allows you to roll back to a known point in time. So you could actually say, the network, you know, whatever it is that was broken used to work a month ago, you could roll back to a month ago. I mean, spot the obvious flaw there. All the changes you've done in the last month might not be worth rolling, shouldn't be rolled back, but okay. You can roll back if you have to.
So, that's right. Yes, that's always nice to have a
rollback. That would be another one of those things that customers are asking for that they probably shouldn't, because when you do it, that would be bad.
You know, I pressed them on this because I thought the whole idea of intent-based networking is that it's supposed to be validated that these changes are going to be good. So why would I need a rollback feature? Because according to IBM, the new config should be okay. They said if there's maybe a bug in an operating system that had some unanticipated consequence, you might want to roll back. And I guess I accept that explanation for this feature.
Yeah, it's another one of these ITIL things. Can you roll it back? Yes, we can roll it back. Okay, you can make the change. Yeah, it's stupid, but it works. It's not stupid sort of thing.
All right, a few more stories before we wrap. And also just want to pause to remind you about our other sponsor, VMware's VMworld. Registration is now open for VMworld at vmworld.com. I feel like VMworld's one of the premier enterprise IT tech conferences. This year it's live and virtual. So you can see all the keynotes, all the presentations, all the technical deep dives. They're going to be covering multi-cloud, Kubernetes, application modernization, networking, and security. Greg, back when we actually went places, this was actually a tech event that Packet Pushers prioritized. Like one of us or sometimes all of us would go to the show.
Yeah, we always tried to get to the major events so that we could. Our main reason was to meet you in the audience if you happened to be going to those events, because that was the most likely thing. And also to be able to meet people in the industry. And by going to the main events, we got to meet most of the people with not being out of position, because being out of position was hard.
Yeah.
Probably the main thing about this is it's actually going to be free, so anybody can join in. There's no reason not to. It runs 24 hours a day, so most of the sessions will be pre-recorded, so you can actually block out the 3 days and then watch the sessions in your local time zone. So if you're in Australia or in Europe or whatever, the schedule actually accommodates all of that, and you can sit in on the sessions that you want to see. So I think this is not different to what other people have done, but I like the fact that they're throwing it open to everybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's lots of good stuff in there. So if you can block out the 3 days and sit at the desk at work and get paid to watch VMworld, I think there'll be stuff in there for you.
Yep. So it starts September 29th, but registration's open now. You can start registering at vmworld.com. All right, back to the news. At this point, I thought I couldn't be shocked by callous corporate behavior when it comes to data breaches, but it turns out there is a new low. So the former security chief at Uber is facing criminal charges for allegedly paying hush money to the attackers who stole 57 million customer records from Uber back in 2016. This person is Joe Sullivan. He is also facing federal charges that include failing to disclose the breach to the FTC.
What, this guy's a piece of work. It took me a fair bit of reading around, but apparently he was previously the chief security officer at Facebook before joining Uber. Mm-hmm. And he was previously a prosecutor at the Department of Justice in California.
He was an assistant U.S. attorney who prosecuted cyber crimes.
Right.
That's what galled me about this. He was on the other side. He knew what he was doing was wrong.
There's no way you can sit there and go like, oh, I didn't know,
right,
or I didn't think it was a problem, or what. No, he was a lawyer who literally prosecuted these crimes. And the even worse, like apparently he was hushing it up inside of Uber, but it was only him and Travis Kalanick who knew about
it. CEO,
and Travis Kalanick actually wrote to him in an email, need to get certainty of what he has, that is the hacker, the sensitivity, exposure on, and confidence that he can truly treat this as a bug bounty situation. Resources can be flexible in order to put this to bed, but we need to document this very tightly. So, A, don't write these things in an email. It's incriminating. It's just like,
right, and don't try to position hush money as a bug bounty payment. That is wrong. It is wrong.
Yeah, and that was a sign of the Uber of that era. I think
totally
the current generation, yeah, it was, you know, it doesn't really matter what you do, just, you know, bro culture, kick heads, take names, close it out, whatever you have to do. Any form of skullduggery is permitted as long as the business grows and, you know, you make more billions of dollars, blah, 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 blah. Nice to see someone get taken down, but, you know.
Well, he hasn't been taken down yet. These are all alleged actions, we should note. These are just charges have been filed. He's going to get his day in court. And by the way, Joe Sullivan is currently chief security officer at Cloudflare, so Cloudflare is going to have some damage control to do as well.
Yeah, Cloudflare is a bit of a place for nut jobs to go and hang out. I mean, Cloudflare continues to defend its right to allow extreme right-wing and extreme left-wing sites on its network in the name of free speech. So it fundamentally supports, you know, really extreme content that should not be on the internet by any societal measure. And I do think it would be bad reputation for Cloudflare to stand by this guy for much longer.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. Aside from being shocked at the new low we've reached, here's a lesson for corporate executives. Don't hide the breach, right? And here's why. It doesn't matter, right? We've seen over and over again, companies have huge breaches, and customers don't walk away. It doesn't affect your share price. Nobody cares. You issue the fake apology. Maybe you offer customers free credit monitoring for a year, and you move on. The problem happens when you lie about it. That's when you suddenly become liable.
That's right.
So indeed. That also
time after time after time after time. That was Equifax all over.
Right.
Same thing, you know?
Yes.
It's not a problem. Don't worry about it. We won't. And we'll do that upgrade later. Don't, you know, hide it. Yeah.
Not that I'm happy with the situation and that customers don't seem to care about security, but don't lie about it. That's where you get into trouble.
Don't lie about it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Anyway, two more stories before we wrap. Greg, you had a story on Apple and their randomizing of Mac addresses.
Yeah. In Apple iOS, when you connect to Wi-Fi, they randomize the MAC address in a number of circumstances. So, for example, when you connect to a given SSID, Apple Mac, the Apple iOS and your Mac will randomize the MAC address for that SSID, and then it will keep a track of it so that you only keep that MAC address whenever you connect to that SSID again. And the Apple iOS 14 beta has actually been creating a rotating MAC address for every SSID every 24 hours. To further improve privacy, right? Because once you connect to somebody's network and you're using that Mac ID, it can be used to track you all around. But if you're on a roaming Wi-Fi network and your Mac address rotates every 24 hours, then that actually forces you to re-log in every day. And global Wi-Fi services or roaming Wi-Fi services are really unhappy because customers don't want to log in every day. So they've been whining at Apple about it. And anyway, so the beta 4 update was they took out the MAC address randomization per day per SSID. And this guy, this blogger for a global roaming Wi-Fi service is going, oh, this is great news. It's fantastic. And I'm going like, but I would not bet I would not bet that Apple would not put that back in. Don't be counting your eggs before they hatch.
Yes.
Sort of thing.
Yes.
But,
Yeah, I will say Apple tends to do a good job when it comes to user privacy, so I would like them to keep this feature. Speaking for myself, I don't mind logging in every day.
Yeah, it sort of makes sense, but it is true that, you know, Wi-Fi services need to find a better way than just tracking by MAC address. And then if that, because that MAC address can be forged, Mm-hmm. It's not exactly secure, right?
Well, clearly.
So, yeah. And so rotating it actually forces them to step up and actually move to the next level and find another way to track a handset to make sure that it's actually, you know, logged in. And if privacy is given to people, I mean, look at the effort we just talked up at the top of the show about ESNI mm-hmm. and the sort of efforts we're willing to go to give user privacy. These global roaming Wi-Fi services should embrace this for the same reason. Hard to sympathize.
Yeah, it is.
To be fair,
it is.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's wrap up with a story on space networking. Speed tests are being reported for trials of the Starlink satellite broadband service. According to a story in Ars Technica, beta users are seeing download speeds of 11 to 60 megabits per second and upload speeds of about 5 to 18 megabits per second.
And not so much the speed, it's the latency. Yeah, you're talking something like 30 to 50 milliseconds, which is excellent. So what people have been doing is trolling through the websites like speedtest.net mm-hmm. and seeing the results being posted. Because when you run a test on speedtest.net, it saves it onto a unique URL. And you can kind of go running down there and looking for them. And obviously people who've got test units have been running speed tests, and so you can see them. So if you're thinking about Starlink and if it's offering you, you know, we don't know much about where these are. So far, they appear to all be in Los Angeles to date. But if you're talking about 50 megs down, 15 megs up, say 10 to 15 megs up, at a 30 to 50 millisecond response time, that is very good, all things considered. Not awesome, just good.
I mean, considering right. It's going to space, yeah, it's not a latency I would be crowing about, but it seems, I guess it's acceptable. We should note that these numbers are not officially coming from Starlink. They're being harvested by folks on Reddit who are curious about this and then publishing them because beta users are supposed to be under NDA. So these aren't official Starlink numbers. It's just some sleuthing by local internet folks.
Yeah, and in the US particularly, where the internet infrastructure is fairly patchy, on the whole, the best as I understand is that a large majority of the US has very poor consumer networks
yes.
of very limited performance. But in some places, it's extraordinary. You know, there are places that actually have fiber, and they get 1 gig from Google things and blah, blah, blah. But the majority of people get very poor. And at this performance level and at this stage of development, you have to assume that some sort of efficiencies will be derived over time, and maybe it gets a little faster. Ping responses are not exactly a perfect measure, but, you know, if you're saying 50 milliseconds, 50 meg down, 15 meg up, that's very good. There is an option there for people to work rural that they could probably live with.
Potentially, yeah, potentially. The United States needs more competition in broadband, so I'm very happy to see the emergence of new options, especially because given that it's satellite, you're not going to run into shenanigans from local telcos denying folks access to poles and lines, et cetera.
Yeah.
So
and that's just the US. Right. Rural Australia, same thing. Rural Europe, there are a lot of places in the countryside of Europe where smaller villages where people just don't set up. Here in the UK, same sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Small villages are quite often stuck on the end of a 2 meg E1. There's 500 houses sharing it, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah. So if you want to be able to go and live in those places, and especially in the post-COVID eras, people want to do remote working, even having this as a backup is not all that bad. So preliminary numbers, space networking is looking solid.
All right. Well, that wraps up the show. Greg, where can folks find you online?
You can find me in open office hours. I'm actually holding an open office, which is just a Zoom call that anybody can join. I'm having two sessions next week, one on Tuesday morning, which covers the Australian time zone and the European time zone, and another one on Friday evening my time, which covers Europe and the US, Pacific time and Eastern Coast. If you want to get together, maybe you've been working from home for too long and you just want to chat to people, I'll be here with coffee on Tuesday and probably alcohol on a Friday.
Okay, so that's August 25th and August 28th with the dates
that's
for people
right.
listening, yes.
And you can find more information on that on etherealmind.com because it's just me. It's not a packet pushes thing. I just wanted to give people a chance to get together. If you're feeling a bit isolated and a bit lonely, come on along. Let's have a chat. We can argue over sports ball things if that makes you happy, or we could argue over your network design.
There's going to be no sports ball conversation from you other than to
I'm just going to laugh at them. I'm just going to say as if I give a toss. But, you know.
Do not bring your sports ball questions to Greg.
Yeah, by all means, join in. It's just a Zoom call. It's free. I'll be there for an hour. Come along. Let's have a chat.
All right. I'm always on Twitter. I'm at Drew_CM. I'm also blogging at packetpushers.net. Thanks to our sponsors, Appster and VMworld. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, tell other folks. That helps us a lot. Check out our membership program. That's ignition.packetpushers.net. For $99 a year, you get exclusive educational videos, white papers, and other content to help your professional IT development. As always, thanks for listening.